In 2002, January 2002, to be precise, the United States transferred the first 20 prisoners from holding cells overseas to the American naval base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. It's not Cuban territory, it's American territory, a legal nicety, as we'll learn in a minute. The prisoners, all suspected of involvement with terrorist activities or connected in some way with Al-Qaeda, were hooded, shackled and initially held in open-air chain-link cages that had been used in the 1990s to hold Haitian refugees. By June 2003, the detainee population at Guantanamo reached a peak of approximately 680 prisoners. There have been numerous allegations over the years of torture, both physical and particularly psychological. Some of those men are still there, 11 years later. Most have never been charged with an offence, and many are at the point of despair, that so much at the point of despair that they will ever be released, that they're deciding to take things into their own hands. And this has come to a head in a hunger strike which has focused world attention on Guantanamo Bay. The only way, the prisoners and their supporters say, to prevent this extremely controversial detention facility from slipping off the radar screen. Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg of the University of San Francisco is a specialist on the detention centre in Guantanamo Bay, and he's the author of a book, Our Nation Unhinged, The Human Consequences of the War on Terror. He's the founder and director of the Witness to Guantanamo project, in which he has filmed interviews of former detainees and prison guards, interrogators, psychologists, prosecutors, and government and military officials. I spoke to him on Thursday and asked him how it is that Guantanamo Bay is still actually open for business.
There was a belief that President Bush, in his last year of office, was planning to close Guantanamo and the Republicans were behind it. But then when President Obama took over, there was a belief that the Republicans decided to block anything Obama did, including closing Guantanamo. Whether that is completely accurate, I'm not sure. Certainly there were lots of problems in closing Guantanamo. There were a lot of men in Guantanamo who they didn't want to release, and they didn't know where to send them. So I think it was a lot more complex than what I just told you, but that was the short part of it.
How much of it is due to Congress simply refusing to allocate the funding?
My opinion is not a lot. I do believe that a lot of people think that Congress is what's stalling it and that President Obama would love to close it, but for Congress. But if you go back to 2009, when President Obama took office and announced he was going to close Guantanamo, at that point he had no congressional legislation blocking him from doing that. He could have that day essentially sent all the prisoners back home or to other countries if they weren't able to be repatriated. But he didn't want to, of course, just open the prison gates. And as he took his time doing it, Congress began passing legislation blocking it, in part requiring the president to go through certain hoops in order to release the men. And unfortunately, President Obama signed these pieces of legislation, so it wasn't just Congress itself. Obama signed legislation which put him along with Congress at blocking the release of the prisoners. So when people say that Obama is a victim here to Congress, it's not at all true that, in fact, he participated. He went too slowly, and he did actually sign the legislation. Having said all that, he still can release the prisoners if he chooses to. And, in fact, there's a belief, I know we're recording this before your show on Sunday, but there's a belief that he's going to announce tomorrow here in the United States that he's going to start the movement to release some of the men at least.
Well, how does he do that? I mean, you've said that he's apparently refused to work with the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, to issue waivers that would allow for the release of the prisoners. I mean, what is the process for issuing a waiver?
He can direct the Secretary of Defense to issue the waiver. Essentially, the Secretary of Defense works for him. He can direct him to sign the waiver and to write a statement that the transfer is in the U.S. interest and national security is protected by releasing these men. And if he directs Hagel to do that, Hagel would do that, and the men could be then released, or at least the men that he wants to release could be released. He can have Hagel sign that waiver if he cares to do that.
So if he doesn't, then the impasse will simply continue, and these men will remain, many of them released, 86 I think have been officially cleared for release years ago, will stay there.
That's correct. I mean, I think it's up to the president to make the bold move and determine that these men are not a security risk and sign the waiver informing Congress of this and releasing these men. Certainly the 86 cleared for release should not be an issue. I mean, they have been cleared for release over 3 years, and they should be released. The other men are a little bit more dicey, but those men, absolutely. Unfortunately, Obama has not had the courage to do that. As of now, he's made a lot of statements. He made a few statements a month ago, but statements, words don't work for me anymore when you consider that he's been there more than 4 years and he hasn't really done anything. And it's time for him to make that bold move and direct the Secretary of Defense to at least begin the process with the 86 men cleared for release.
In 2011, a couple of years ago, President Obama signed the Defense Authorization Bill, which at least partly placed restrictions on the transfer of Guantanamo Bay prisoners to the mainland or to foreign countries. What was the big imperative here? Was it to prevent them coming to the mainland, or was it difficulties in finding ways of releasing them somewhere else?
I think both are true. I think there are a lot of people who do not want these men to come to the mainland on any account, no matter what, even if they are, quote, cleared for release, and even if they are, quote, innocent. I think that part is absolutely true. There's a lot of communities that do not want these men there. I mean, the fact is, a lot of people believe these men are no more dangerous and probably a lot less dangerous than a lot of the men we have in prison in the U.S., so it's not quite certain that these men shouldn't be released into the U.S., but in fact, that's not going to happen. I mean, there's too much political movement here to stop anybody from coming into the U.S. from Guantanamo. In terms of releasing to other countries, I think part of that is the Republicans wanting to block the president from doing anything effective at all. And like I said, the president signed the legislation, so he's at fault as well. He did not have to sign the legislation. But in fact, that does block it going to other countries as well without the waiver that you discussed just a few minutes ago.
Why did he deem it necessary to buckle on this one, which is of worldwide importance and which will leave a stain on his presidency unquestionably if these people aren't released by the time he moves on?
I think you nailed the question. I think that's exactly right. What you said in that question is what a lot of Americans do not know. The fact is, Guantanamo is a stain to the rest of the world. The rest of the world is very aware of Guantanamo, but Americans are not. Shockingly, perhaps to your listeners, Americans don't pay attention to Guantanamo in large part. In fact, I don't know if you know, we run a project called Witness to Guantanamo, where we go around the world interviewing former detainees and other people who were involved with Guantanamo. And when I tell people what we're doing here in America, a lot of people say, that's not an issue. Guantanamo's closed. And I have to explain to them, in fact, it's not. And so even educated Americans who you would respect as being quite informed are not informed on Guantanamo at all, except for the last month when there's been some movement and some noise in the newspapers. But even so, this issue is not at all played out in the American press. Hardly ever. And most people, after they heard Obama say he was going to close it back in 2009, think somehow it's been closed. So what you're describing is exactly right. The world sees Guantanamo as a stain on us and on who we are and on the presidency, but Americans don't think about Guantanamo at all. They think about the economy and many other issues, but Guantanamo's not on that list.
Yes, very interesting. Let's go back in time a bit. The original rationale for establishing it there at a naval base way offshore, as it were. Was it originally contested legally? Was that decision to set that up in 2001 ever contested legally?
Well, ultimately it was in terms of going to the Supreme Court, where the Bush administration could set it up. I mean, they could do whatever they wanted. They had the military base, but their determination was to say that the men who they held in Guantanamo were somehow outside U.S. law, which was contested and which the Supreme Court in 2004 said that's not true. These men are under the auspices of U.S. law. And that was the first time it was stated by a high court like that. So until then, the Bush administration argued that, in fact, somehow they were not at all affected by U.S. law, which would have meant that it was a lawless community and the Bush administration could have done whatever it wanted to these men.
At the outset, they decided that they could ignore the Geneva Conventions in this context.
That's right.
And that meant all bets were off in terms of the treatment of prisoners. These were military.
That's right. They circumvented the Geneva Conventions, which was Geneva Conventions we've signed, America has signed, all nations in the world have signed, and it is part of our legal system. And in fact, they had no right to circumvent the Geneva Conventions, but they did. And unfortunately, you know, there was not much that we could do. And when the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 2004 that American law applied, they didn't really work with the Geneva Conventions. It wasn't until 2006 in a separate Supreme Court decision that Geneva Conventions were brought back in to American law and Guantanamo. That was a different decision. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The Bush administration ignored the Geneva Conventions.
What hard evidence is there of torture?
You find torture in different situations. I mean, I think the extraordinary renditions, and I'm hoping you and your listeners know what that is, where we abducted people and sent them to countries around the world, including, you know, Egypt and Syria,
yeah,
and had them tortured there. I think everyone believes that was torture. That was done by the CIA, and that was kept below the radar. I think that's been heavily documented by the international community. In terms of Guantanamo, well, you know, Chris, it's kind of interesting. The fact is that there was probably more physical torture in Afghanistan, in Bagram and Kandahar, when we first picked up the prisoners. Perhaps your listeners know that very few of the people we, quote, captured and sent to Guantanamo were actually captured by U.S. forces. They were actually purchased by the U.S. from Afghanis and Pakistanis who grabbed them and sold them to the United States. The U.S. dropped leaflets over Afghanistan and Pakistan said, if you bring us Al-Qaeda and Taliban soldiers, we'll pay you for that. And we paid very handsomely, often $3,000. And that, of course, was a gold mine to the locals. And so they grabbed any Arab on the street and sold them. And we bought anyone they brought to us. And so most of the people that we first, quote, captioned sent to Guantanamo were really purchased by us. And they were first taken to Afghanistan, to Bagram and Kandahar Air Force bases. And there they were physically tortured. And that's been documented, too. And then they were sent to Guantanamo. And what's interesting in the detainees we interviewed who were in Guantanamo, so many of them told us that the torture they suffered in Guantanamo was usually not that physical. They certainly were beaten at times in situations. And one man who is still there was actually tortured. But most of the people described Guantanamo as a psychological prison, meaning that they were kept in isolation and they were treated in other ways that essentially was much more psychologically oriented than physical. And to them, that was worse. To them, to be in isolation for a long period of time was much more devastating than the physical beatings. And one man even quoted to us as saying when he came out of Guantanamo and he told people he was tortured in Guantanamo, they said, we don't see any signs on you. There's no beatings. You show nothing. He said, no, it was all in my head. And he said they wouldn't understand that. So how you define torture, to me, the isolation is much worse than the physical. These men certainly thought so.
I mean, it was only until, I think, January 2009 that a reviewer, I've forgotten her name now, was a government reviewer who admitted openly, or at least publicly, that Mohammed al-Qahtani, and I think this is the person you're talking about before who was tortured, right?
Right.
Was being held prisoner there. And this was the first Bush administration official to concede openly that torture had occurred.
That was Susan Crawford, right?
That's right, Susan Crawford. Was there not then an open and shut case for a rather more full-scale investigation of this, of the circumstances that pertained there?
Absolutely, but so what?
I mean, nothing happened.
I mean, how many countries will do the work that's necessary to own up to what they did? I mean, obviously Obama said when he first took office he's going to look forward, not backward. You know, yeah, you're totally right. But in fact, that's not happening, you know. Everyone thought he would go after Cheney, but instead he said, no, he's moving forward.
Yes.
I mean, so yes, absolutely, it should have been. And there are, of course, classified investigations that, you know, some people believe Obama might release another investigation that the government undertook. That is entirely classified about what happened post 9/11. But as of now, he hasn't. And yes, you're absolutely right. We should have done a lot more work, and we haven't. No one's interested, really. Yeah. I think you nailed that, too, when you said, you know, people don't really care about the men in Guantanamo. No one's really interested in owning up to how we treated another human being.
It's pretty obvious that a lot of people outside the United States cared because, in 2006, among many other examples, the United Nations called unsuccessfully for the camp to be closed. And one judge in that context observed, and I think it's very telling words, America's idea of what is torture does not appear to coincide with that of most civilized nations. How widely did that echo within the United States? Did anybody pick it up?
It didn't. I mean, I will tell you that, you know, we've interviewed people for the project who are reviled by what happened in Guantanamo and who feel that, of course, we've tortured and are very upset with the way we are. And these are conservatives. A lot of people we interviewed are very conservative people who really believe in the rule of law and human rights, and they are just appalled at what behavior the Bush administration underwent and what Obama is not revealing. Having said that, most people aren't there. Most people don't think about it. And the people who do, I admire them greatly, and so many of them really care, the ones we interview. But a lot of people just don't pay attention to this. And the statement you just made just doesn't get a lot of press. The newspapers are complicit here. They don't play up this because they know the American citizenry isn't really interested. So they don't put it on the front page of newspapers if they place it anywhere in the paper at all.
I'm talking to Peter Jan Honigsberg, the author of Our Nation Unhinged. The report of the Guantanamo Review Task Force, which reported back in 2010, early beginning of 2010, it reported apparently on all 240 detainees, and from what I understand, they discovered 36 were the subject of active cases of investigations. 30.
Oh, you mean where they made a decision as to which men they should release and which men...
That's right.
They made some decisions as to which men are cleared for release, which men should be held indefinitely, and which men should be prosecuted. That's correct, yes.
So 86 of the 240 were cleared.
Well, actually, if you're going back to 240, 60 of them... Obama has released 60 men.
Right. That was my next question. Who came out?
Who came out were people that were cleared for release and that Ambassador Dan Freed was able to find homes for or was able to get them repatriated. So they went through some of these people, I guess. I guess they made their choices on who was the least likely to become a problem in the future, and what countries are willing to take these men, and when they were able to connect them, they did release them. So of those 86 left, I mean, as you know, 56 are Yemeni, and by 09, the president wasn't releasing any more Yemeni detainees.
Have there been any trials at all of any of the detainees there?
Well, there actually were 7 convictions so far, 5 of which were plea deals, and there was 1 trial and 1. Actually, there was a 2nd trial where the person didn't participate, so they got 7 convictions out of that. Those trials are all questionable, as you probably know. I mean, a lot of people feel the military commissions are faulty in so many different ways that these trials will get. In fact, some of these cases have been thrown out already, and they feel that the others will be thrown out as well, and they still can't get it correct in terms of how to prosecute these men. But the trials are so few and far between, no one expects there'll be many more trials, although the government claims they could prosecute as many as 34 people. No one sees that happening because they can't even get it right on the 7 they did prosecute where they got plea deals, and they still got problems with the plea deals. They just don't. They're just not following the rule of law.
7 were convicted, you say?
Well, yeah, 5 were plea deals. So
right,
I call that a conviction, but it wasn't a trial. It was, you know, these men. You know, I mean, one of the sad things is we interviewed one prosecutor who said to us, the best way to get out of Guantanamo is to do a plea deal, admit guilt of some kind, and they release you. The fact is, That is true. A lot of people got out merely by, or those people got out by merely by confessing to something that they might or might not have done in order to get released. David Hicks, as you know from Australia, made it very clear that he would have sworn to anything, any charges at all. He didn't care what they were. If the end result was he'd be released, that's all he wanted. He wanted out of Guantanamo. He didn't care what he swore to and what he pled to. But the fact is there's a lot of people who believe his plea deal is totally invalid. What he pled to is not really a crime.
But at least he's out.
He's out, and that's what he wanted, exactly. And that's what other people agreed to do. Omar Khadr, who went to Canada, pled to something that apparently a lot of people believe he didn't do, again, to get out. And now he's in prison in Canada, but at least he has a chance of being released once he's in Canada. So I think a lot of people feel if they can just do a plea agreement, they'll get out. And the U.S. is happy because they have something on paper saying this person is, quote, guilty. But then it's questioned afterwards and often and sometimes even thrown out.
Yes. Many of those who are still there have decided not to go that route. They're on hunger strike and some presumably by now very close to death. Some being force-fed, which is, again, arguably torture.
That's right.
What is likely to be the outcome of that? Will they just continue to force-feed these guys until they give up and accept that they're not going to be allowed to die and become martyrs? What happens if some do die and become martyrs? Well, they'll have to cover that up. Otherwise, you get a worldwide response. You get a huge influx into anti-American young Islamist activity, all of that. What's your guess as to what will happen now?
Well, what's interesting is the military started, you probably know this, but the military started moving the prisoners who were on hunger strike into individual cells. They were in a communal situation prior to that, but they moved into individual cells in the hope that they wouldn't communicate with each other and not encourage each other to continue the hunger strike and then break it. But in fact, it's been going on now since January, and even when they moved them into single cells over a month ago, the same number of men are still on hunger strike, and apparently they're continuing even though they're not necessarily communicating with each other every day as they were prior. Maybe they still are communicating through other methods, but they try to put them in single cells to avoid that. Apparently, it changes each day as to how many people are force-fed. Today, the number is 31. 103 people are actually on hunger strike, and 31 are being force-fed. The way the government looks at it, if you haven't eaten in 10 days, I believe, or 9 days, then on 10th they begin to force-feed you. So only 31 of the 103 are being force-fed, and today one person's in the hospital. That's changed. It's been as many as 5 in the hospital where they're fed, I guess, intravenously because they're getting close to death. And apparently 4 of them were released from the hospital, and only 1 is there now. So I think the government's doing everything it can to make sure these men don't die, because you said it correctly, that if they do die, it'll become an international issue, and the government doesn't want that. And so they'll do everything they can to keep these people alive. Absolutely correct. And a lot of people do believe that is torture, and that these men have the right to die if they consciously make that decision, and that's under certain declarations, the Malta Declaration, and the U.S. government won't abide by that.
Your organization has filmed interviews with many of the prisoners, and which will go into, as I understand, an archive that will be available publicly. Is this a kind of insurance effort? You've modelled it on the Shoah catastrophe approach, which is collecting Holocaust stories so that nobody can say this didn't happen. How far advanced are you on that?
Well, we've interviewed 104 people, 45 of whom are former detainees. The rest are Americans who were in Guantanamo living or working, such as interpreters and interrogators, prison officials, guards, military officials. And we're still interviewing people, but a lot of detainees now would like to move on with their lives and no longer want to talk about their situation in Guantanamo. So we're pleased that we've gotten that many, 45, to at least tell their stories on camera for about 2 hours each. and the other Americans actually help augment it, because a lot of people sometimes think that the detainee, Americans at least, think the detainees might be lying, but you have Americans who stood before our camera and say, no, the detainees did not lie. This is really what happened to them. We observed it. We watched it. We saw it happen. So I think you do have documentation. Unfortunately, I don't think this will be widely watched until a generation or two pass. If you know, when we incarcerated Japanese Americans back in World War II, it took us two generations to own up to what we had done. And I suspect that it might be that long before Americans can finally face what we did in Guantanamo. And I probably won't be here then, but the material, the films, videos will be here. And so Americans will be able to see their faces and hear the voices of the people who were in Guantanamo tell their stories of what it was like. And you're right, it will be there for history.
That was Peter Jan Honigsberg, a law professor at the University of San Francisco and the founder and director of the Witness to Guantanamo Project. Its website is witnesstoguantanamo.com. And the day after we recorded that interview, President Obama renewed his pledge to close Guantanamo and lifted the self-imposed ban on transferring cleared detainees to Yemen. Most of the Yemeni prisoners were captured more than a decade ago, so the wheels may be finally turning.